ऐसी मशीन लगाऊंगा इस साइड से आलू बनेगा उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा।
Hi, this is the Talking Stuff Network and you're listening to Attention Please episode 41, recorded on 19th May and I'm Vikram Mohan. Today is the final phase of the elections at last and tomorrow morning India time, we have the series finale of Game of Thrones. And to give us a little bit of perspective on both, we have our host Arnab. Hey Arnab, from a woman driven by revenge to master schemers to frankly people without balls. Lot of similarity between our politics and Game of Thrones, right?
That's very well said, actually. And also, the similarities are amazing. So you have dictators who would prefer to burn down a city. You have people who consider themselves born to rule, and they happen to be finishing on the same day. So there's a lot of similarity between Game of Thrones, and I think another similarity is that the substantial amount of people will be unhappy with however it turns out to be.
Oh, true.
So today, in today's episode, we want to cover Game of Thrones. So we'll cover Game of Thrones. This is possibly going to be the penultimate time I'll be ever talking about Game of Thrones. So for those of you who do not follow Game of Thrones, first question is, I don't know why you don't follow Game of Thrones. It is pretty much one of the greatest epic, most epic stories ever told on television. You might have opinions as to whether it could have been better or whether the writers dropped the ball in the final season, which, again, we'll come to that, is not a criticism that's limited to Game of Thrones. Many of the greatest TV series of all time have had fans, including Breaking Bad, who were very disappointed with the last season. So it's always a problem that...
Wow.
Excuse me?
I find it hard to believe that somebody had a problem with Breaking Bad. I
mean, yes.
The most yes.
So they had a big problem with the last episode of Breaking Bad. They felt that Ozymandias was a great episode. It was not so much with the whole last season of Breaking Bad, but definitely with the last episode. There was a lot of criticism that somehow... In terms of... I'm wrong. There was criticism of the last season also. They felt that the introduction, and for those of you who find this familiar with respect, this kind of similar kind of criticism that is, that Game of Thrones is now getting, was that they felt that the writers tried very hard at the end. Suddenly, at the very end, abruptly, they introduced those neo-Nazis in Breaking Bad.
Right.
So they felt that was a sudden at the end inclusion, and they felt that that was purely done because they wanted to redeem the character of Walter White. And the only way they could redeem a character who had gone so far down the rabbit hole of evil was to bring it to the absolute evil and to make him look good in comparison to it. So they felt that was a lazy plot device and that it detracted from the awesomeness of Breaking Bad. So
let me ask you something.
Yes.
This is something, I mean, totally on the other end of the spectrum. Even in something as different as Friends, one of the, I don't know if you're a fan of sitcoms or whether you're one of the few left in the world who has not watched Friends. I assume you have.
I have, of course.
Okay.
Growing up in the 90s, I mean, I have mixed
exactly.
feelings. I always had mixed feelings about Friends, but it was, again, part of the cultural zeitgeist. So, of course, I watched Friends. And I actually watched the last episode live also. So.
Oh, you did. So one of the complaints which I've heard even on Friends or similar to even Game of Thrones, Breaking Bad, is that for a series which has gone on for so long, I mean, almost all of them have spanned a decade. And obviously the characters would undergo significant change. Even if we look at ourselves, I'm not the same person I was a decade ago. But whereas when it comes to these characters, I have heard people say, oh no, Ross started off this way. Towards the end, he became a loser. Chandler was this way. He became this way. People want characters to remain frozen in time. Whereas, I mean, it's to be expected that when there's a long story, the characters would change, wouldn't it?
Right. So I remember when I was a more active author and I had grand dreams of becoming a full-time author. This was around the time Yatrik came out. So I was at Pune Lit Fest, and I remember there was somebody in the audience who said something which I found actually very, very educative. I think she, what she said was, we don't want original stories. We want familiar stories. So people, even when they say they want originality, they actually don't want originality. Books, TV series, all, there has to be, sure, there has to be a certain element of originality, but there also needs to be significant dollops of familiarity. So when, and this familiarity is not just for the specific theme of what you're seeing, but the fidelity of the characters. So you expect, and we're going to come to that with Game of Thrones and with anything which runs this long, is that ultimately, after some time, people become so invested in the characters, which is a good thing. But they also feel that they are responsible for writing the ends of the characters, that they become disappointed when the vision of the writers don't match with theirs. Because the writers are going for originality. They're trying to, and that is really their artistic vindication. They want to take it to a place where artistically it has not been done before. But for the audience, that's not where they want it to go. They want it to go to a safe spot of familiarity where this is how we thought it would always end. And if it doesn't, then you have this audience backlash. And this is, again, I'm saying Game of Thrones isn't the first pop culture phenomenon which has faced this. I don't think that Friends faced it to that level, but Friends wasn't deep stuff, right? So Friends was much more frothy. It was
right.
For us growing up in India in those times without social media, this was a idealized, romanticized look at what youth culture in the US is. Of course, it's very different. Even people here know that it is, you know, trying to get an idea of what youth culture in the US is through Friends is like, you know, this is a simile I used last time, is by looking at Student of the Year and trying to understand, you know, the educational culture in India. These are idealizations, these are romanticizations. I wish it was like this. So characters grow, and especially in something like Game of Thrones, which for those of you who listen to this podcast regularly, I've said this for a long time, is that Game of Thrones is fairly unique in the sense that it is less of a story-driven narrative than a character-driven narrative. So it is all about a number of characters who intersect, their fates intersect, and then they again go along their own path. And the story of Game of Thrones has never been its strong suit. And that has been deliberate. That has been the vision of George R.R. Martin, that he really wants to take about 20 characters, I would say 20, 25 characters, equally important characters, and he just wants to, like, multi-threaded programs. He just wants to run them. He wants to execute them. And sometimes they communicate and sometimes they just run. And whatever comes out is what he believes is a simulation of life. So that is really what Game of Thrones is. It is a simulation of life. It is not really a story with a beginning, medium, end. The classic Greek three-phase way of building a narrative where you have... So the classic Greek narrative structure is you have three parts to any story. So the first part ends when the hero encounters his first big challenge. So before that, it's development. And the crucial conflict in the story is when it becomes evident, becomes the one-third, roughly lengthwise one-third. Right? There's no hard and fast rule for that. And the second part of the story is the challenge essentially becomes even more challenging. So more obstacles get thrown in his way. The problem isn't even as simple as he thought it was. And the last one-third part of it is resolution. And we have all grown up, because whoever's read books or watched movies, we've kind of internalized this structure. So when the structure is bucked, as in Game of Thrones, where you do not have a resolution, and people are trying to shoehorn a resolution into a place where there was never going to be a resolution to start with. So what, for me, the success of Game of Thrones is... it's a wrong question to ask, did things happen the way I wanted them to? It was never going to be that way. Game of Thrones, primarily, the primary thesis of Game of Thrones was anybody can die. You know, taking it a step back, it's not anybody can die. It is that your expectations are going to be subverted. That is the real thing. This is not your father's fantasy book. Okay, so... do not think that the way you have thought of large narratives or thought of princes and dragons, this is not that story. This is going to take tropes and they're going to subvert those tropes. That has always been, G.R.R. Martin has always worked the best when he has done this. So whether it be the Red Wedding or Ned Stark's beheading, all of it, it is, yes, it is a shocking event, true. But it is, but the basic thing is, you didn't expect this now, did you? Is really what Martin is saying. Now, in if you count success as you didn't expect this, then the race franchise would be the pinnacle of art, right? Because you never expect anything. Bizarre things happen in race all the time. And nothing is as it seems. Like every time, every 5 minutes, it changes. So the reason what makes race to be trash and this to be great is that race does not have any consistent set of rules by which these changes happen. The changes happen because the writer thought, "Arey yaar, ye karte hain." So that is bad writing. So again, once you set the rules, the changes or have to happen within the context of those rules of the world you've set. So yes, we have rules where dragons fly. I mean, that's not realistic. But once we have said that dragons fly, you have to make sure that you follow a consistent set of rules. And I would think that Game of Thrones would have failed if it had failed its internal consistency. And I will explain why I claim that, is that it hasn't. That everything that has happened is the way it was supposed to happen. If you think about it a little close. So first of all, I know that there has been a tremendous backlash against Game of Thrones season 8. I think some of the actors themselves have expressed their misgivings because the actors, as you know, are not told about the story well in advance because of the reason for secrecy. They are told information purely on a need-to basis. And the stars, some of the stars at least, have not, been ambivalent about it. Of course, I'm sure their contracts prevent them from actually expressing their true feeling. And the fans, there is now even a petition online with 50,000 signatures asking for a reshoot of the season 8, which just goes to show that first world problems. So
what? Seriously?
Yes. So again, this is not unique. So I don't know, have you ever played a game called Mass Effect?
No, haven't heard of it.
So there was a game called Mass Effect, which, so before I go to Game of Thrones, let's talk about Mass Effect. So back in the days when I didn't have a daughter and I had a lot more time, I used to play not a lot of games, but at least one major role-playing game every year. And a major role-playing game is usually a investment in time of about 60 to 70 hours. So it's a significant amount of investment just on playing game, like just being in front of the screen for 70 hours. I used to really like doing that. What I normally would do was that at the end of the year, I was there in Maryland, you would have all the leave that I didn't take. So I would take the leave at the end of the year. It was use it or lose it. And my birthday is on December 30th. So this was like total holiday mode. I would buy a game. And for about 4 or 5 days, I would sit in front of the computer. I would sit in front of my Xbox and stuff. And I would just sleep sometimes there itself. And yes, very unhealthy and not to be recommended. But that was the way I used to do it. I would absolutely be immersed in that world. So I would just be there. And my wife used to say that I wouldn't eat. She always says, if you play games, you stop eating. And that was true. I just stopped eating. I would just be there. I would not feel any hunger, nothing. I would be so totally absorbed in that world. I haven't done this for years now. But coming back to Mass Effect. So with Mass Effect, it was a trilogy. And I'm going to give spoilers for Mass Effect. So for those of you who haven't played it or want to play it, this might be a good time to just forward the audio for a while. So in Mass Effect, it's a standard trope of aliens invading the universe, the evil aliens invading universe. And this one character, which is you, kind of fighting with a group of other good aliens to save the universe. There's nothing really unique about it. But the ending, so at the end, you have played the 3 episodes of Mass Effect, 3 games. So you've played about 210 hours of this game, okay, personally. So you're that invested in the game. So at the end, you find out that the universe is never going to be saved in any case. So you might as just sit here and watch the universe be destroyed. So fans were absolutely, absolutely livid at the end. They felt that they had been cheated out of, like, I had played 210 hours. There are people who had played like 500 hours and they replayed. It was like a cult. And so this was digital, right? So they actually came up with another ending. Okay, so they didn't change the ending fundamentally, but they made certain changes in the ending purely based on fan backlash. I personally loved the original ending because I remember I just sat there, my jaw open, because so far it had been so formulaic. But then at the end, I just felt it just... I know exactly what happened. I know that it would seem that why was I playing this game if this was the ending? But I just was so surprised by that ending. I found it amazing. Again, my expectations were subverted, and this was definitely not a work of art. But it was true. At least it wasn't a race like kind of twist. It was consistent with, if you thought about it, it was consistent with what they had done. And again, the narrative is very shallow there. This is, after all, a computer game. It is nowhere in comparison to Game of Thrones. But the reason I bring it up is because fans don't like stuff, and sometimes things do get changed. They do get changed, at least in the Realm software. I don't think that they're going to reshoot a Game of Thrones season 8. The chance of that happening is zero. But unfortunately, and here's the problem. So when something like Game of Thrones starts out, it kind of starts out as like nobody actually watches it. Like, how many people had even read the books before the TV series came out? Nobody had even heard of it. So as these things become mainstream phenomenon, so in the first few episodes, it was still selective. And then through social media and through word of mouth, it became a phenomenon. So the problem with something ever becoming a phenomenon is two things. Firstly, you can never satisfy anyone, and just the space of dissatisfied people keeps on increasing. And second is that, well, guess what? You know, the more people who watch it, the lower you have to set your standard, honestly, in order to make it popular. You cannot keep it at that level. Now, I'm really sorry to the Game of Thrones fans who are butthurt by this ending, but unfortunately, to use a word of a line from Ramsay Bolton, you haven't been paying attention. So let's first look at perhaps the biggest complaint about Game of Thrones is the sudden descent into madness of Daenerys Targaryen. So based on multiple articles that I've read, people are dissatisfied by this sudden, very fast descent of Daenerys Targaryen into pure evil. So I remember somebody saying, you know, those who named their daughters Khaleesi must be regretting it now. And the problem with this is I don't think it's rushed. I think if you look very carefully at the character of Daenerys Targaryen, from day one, from the first episode that she comes in, there is something about her. It's some of her fundamental beliefs is that she actually inherently believes, this is not a put-on act, but this is that she is the savior of mankind. Okay. And that she has a kind of holy mission to save mankind. Okay, I will break the wheel. This is the fifth season or something where she says it. From the first time that we see her introduced, she sees herself as a savior. Now, have you seen the Satyajit Ray movie called Devi?
No.
Okay. Sorry. So in this movie Devi, which is I think one of Satyajit Ray's finest works, Sharmila Tagore plays a young bride who is, this is set in, you know, British India. So she is married into a zamindar family, where the zamindar he sees a dream where God, at least he claims that God comes to him and says that his new daughter-in-law is an incarnation of God. So what they do is they start worshipping her. They make her into a deity, a human being. They make her into a deity and they start worshipping her. And of course, her husband, who's a rationalist, who goes, he's aghast at this. But this is the village, this is the 18th century, so there's nothing really he can do because his father is like really the patriarch. And so everybody starts worshipping her. And then, I've forgotten, sorry, a long time ago, then there was this little boy who's, I think her nephew, so I think it's her nephew. So the boy gets sick, okay? And they feel that, you know, she's God, so she can bring, I mean, she can cure him, but she can't. And that little boy who, this girl, who's not a very old too, really likes, you know, he dies. And then she realizes herself that she is not God. So it's because he has been, and she dies at the end too, but she becomes mad. You know, she loses her mental stability because she comes to internalize the fact that she is God also. And so when she finds, when that realization hits her that she is not God, it totally flips her around. It's stupid. You say, why would somebody believe that somebody is God? But when everybody around you tells you you're God, 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 after some point of time, you start believing in it. You start believing in it inside. It's not, you know, like fake sadhus who know they aren't, but they're putting on an act. It is something which is even more deeper and tragic, is that you yourself start believing in that BS. And to quote something from Scarface, you never should get high on your own supply. Okay. So the reason why I bring this up is this is precisely what happens to Dane. So if you look at the way the episodes go, initially when she attains, you know, when she gets her dragons and in Meereen and all these other places, she goes to liberate people. And what happens? The people are thankful to her. They make her into a god. Remember that scene where they all like reach out their hands to touch her?
Yeah,
like
she's
God. So she starts believing that she's God herself. Whether it's God, you know, that she is divine. That it is her divine right to rule. And that she is the person who's been chosen by fate to rescue people from the evil system. Till in this season, she realizes that everything she's come to believe is wrong. First of all, she is not the first to the throne. There is somebody else. So she's actually not been chosen by fate. Point number one. And point number two, that once she comes to Westeros, she sees that nobody is thankful. She believes people should be thankful to her. They should fall at her feet. Nobody really cares about her. They are more thankful to Jon Snow. Even though technically you could see that Jon Snow hasn't really done much either for them. He's a pretty lousy warrior, but this just happens to be that he's a more likable person. So people kind of gravitate towards him. So this is that there are two things which she comes in and she sees. She sees that people don't care for her. They are not thankful. And she has internalized that she is there as a savior. So when she turns the dragonfire on Westeros, she says, okay, if it's not love, let it be fear. Because she's at this point desperate for some kind of feeling from people. She's desperate for something, some kind of reaction to her. What she sees is that people are ignoring her. Not only they are just indifferent to her at all. I mean, she has some dragons, okay. Dragons also die. She's not that great either. So she, at that point of time, this is what would happen to somebody like her who has grown up as a young woman, used to being worshipped and there's another thing which collapsed right before that. Throughout her whole journey, there have been two people, Missandei and Jorah Mormont, who have kind of acted as her bubble around her. They've always protected her from everything else. You know, you're great, you're divine, you're awesome. They've always kind of given that to her. So those were the psycho friends that she had. Now those two people are dead too. Which brings in the only person left is Tyrion, and she's not convinced, and she's right too. That Tyrion isn't really beholden to her in that way. That Tyrion has his own conception of what the world should be like. And that Tyrion is not devoted to her. She's devoted to a principle. And so she's smart enough to realize that. So what happens when she goes over the edge? This is exactly what it was working up towards. And in a Facebook post, I had compared her to Indira Gandhi. If you read several biographies of Indira Gandhi, one common theme that comes out is that Indira Gandhi always felt from a child, when she was a child, that she was ordained by fate to rescue Indians from themselves. This unwashed, dark country that she and her family effectively has to. This is a delusion that all Gandhis suffer from. Okay. The Khaleesi complex. All of them have it. So, but she had definitely had this. So she publicly would tell her biographers. So, you know, whenever in an interview, she would always say, I don't want to be a prime minister. Everybody wants me to be a prime minister. It's really, I want to be a prime minister. And if that was true, then she wouldn't have declared emergency. The emergency was that point. It was Indira Gandhi's dragon fire moment. It was the point exactly. of time she realized that not only are the people not thankful to her, okay, or thankful to her and her family, they are willing to remove her. And that's the when she flips. And she does something absolutely insane. She throws everybody in jail for doing that. This is the exactly that Khaleesi moment that she had. This happens. This does not happen because this is the development of a certain character. And I felt it was absolutely consistent with the way the Khaleesi character had been built. And I don't think that this was sudden. It's just that a lot of events suddenly happened, which, you know, made her, you know, to go to the dark side. It's absolutely within character. The second thing that I want to talk about was Arya. So again, another set of criticisms that I saw was what the F was going on with Arya? She goes there to kill. So let's take a step back. So for many people, they think, because in a way the story has built up to that, so they can't totally be blamed that there's going to be a very satisfying revenge at the end. Everybody is going to get their revenge. That, and this is what happens in conventional stories, that, you know, you killed my father, now prepare to die. So there's always this payoff, there's always this revenge that the bad person gets their comeuppance, so as to say. So when people are finding that they're not getting that scene of, let's say, Arya killing Cersei in some shape or form, they're disappointed by that. Cersei shouldn't die in a cave like that, buried alone. But that's the way the world of Westeros is. Now, before we get to that, let's just analyze what actually happens there. So both Arya and the Hound, they start walking towards King's Landing. Both of them have their job cut out for them. One is going to kill Cersei because she's, I think, is the last remaining person on her list. Of course, Hound is also on her list, but that's another thing.
Right.
And the Hound is going to kill his brother. So these two people are going there. And at this point of time, their journeys have again coincided. They're both basically walking. They're going to kill two people who are going to be side by side. Then they walk into the keep. Okay. At which point of time, this is where people are befuddled by what happens. Is that the Hound tells her. What does the Hound tell her, actually, if you recall that scene? Which I felt was extremely powerful. The Hound tells her that, you know, both... And again, there's not a lot of exposition. So many people believe that these should be spelled out for them. Game of Thrones doesn't really care to spell it out. But that's what he's saying. So at that point of time, both of them realize that with the dragon flying outside and with that entire Red Keep collapsing, they're not going to come out of this place alive if they go further. So what he does is he basically tells her that, look, I know why you're here and I know you're here for revenge and I'm here for revenge too, but you have a life ahead of you. Okay, you have many great things to live for. There are a lot of things. Is this how you want to die? With revenge? Is Cersei that important that you are willing to stub out all the possibilities that you have for this person? For me, I don't have a life left. For me, this is it. So I have to die. This is the way I choose to go. But I think you shouldn't. I think there's a lot more for you. That's really what he says. Of course, he doesn't say it in so many words. And Arya is smart enough to understand that. And she says, thank you at that point of time. Because that is the last part of Arya's education. If you've seen Arya through the episodes, she has killed a lot of people in revenge. And she has kind of taken some amount of delight in doing so. So there is a part of this darkness in her too. But the last lesson that a warrior needs to learn, and I might be proven wrong tomorrow, she is Ahura Sahai. That's why the white horse comes at the end. So the last lesson on her path is that not only when to fight, but when to withdraw from combat. When to realize that the fight isn't worth it. That whatever you have kind of built yourself up to, if your life has worked to some kind of revenge or some kind of goal, there is at one point of time that you have to realize that the cost of attaining that is just too great. and I have to withdraw. There are much better things that I should be doing. And that's the lesson she learns. And that's why she says, thank you. And I felt that was totally in sync with way they're building Arya up to be essentially the hero. Because remember, she's the person who's killed the Night Walker, the White Walker. So again, there's a lot of subtlety in Game of Thrones. And they're doing it right. The only thing that I didn't like was the thing that people liked, which was the Clegane Bowl. I felt that was everybody knew that the two brothers were going to fight. There was nothing dramatic in it. This was exactly the way it was going to end. They were going to all both die together, and it just reminded me there was such a strong sense of deja vu of the seventh or was it the eighth Harry Potter film. Where Harry and Voldemort, Harry says, let's finish this the way we started together, and holds Voldemort. And, there's also this whole burning Hogwarts, everything is in fire, and they jump off. So it just reminded me so much of that. I just even felt the sequence itself wasn't as thrilling that it could have been. And I just felt this was formula. This was things tying itself beautifully together. This brother hates the brother. They come out at the very end and they fight to death. And both the brothers jump into the fire, which was where that guy, the evil brother, had put the good brother's face in. So it was all so very convenient and so very plotted that I felt that was what was not in sync with the general philosophy of Game of Thrones. The beautiful thing of Game of Thrones is life never happens the way we think it should. That life never follows a plot. That when Arya goes to kill Cersei, she realizes at the last moment, you know what? I'd rather not. And, Cersei, evil Cersei does not get people. See, that's the thing. If you want a conventional story, then Game of Thrones is not the place for you. I thought it was a beautiful play the way, Cersei dies, because it's not, you expect a violent person like her to meet a very personal violent end, but she doesn't in a way.
And at that point, you actually empathize with her because she's pregnant. She just says that I want my baby to live. I never thought I would actually feel sorry for her, but honestly, in that scene, I did.
Yeah, so if you look at that, again, it's a minor point, but this perhaps comes out more in the books than it comes out in the TV series, is that everybody knew that they were brother and sister in love with each other, and their main thing was that the world does not exist for us, that we are our own world. And that essentially is really what, at the very end, before they die, that's what Jamie is trying to tell her, to take her mind off what's going to happen. That he's trying to protect her at that point from using that thing which he used to tell her all the time in a very different context. In a very, very different context. But that, it's any novel thing. When you have a callback moment where you use a line, this is a very standard way that people do it. They use a line in... Right. Used pages before, but in a different context where the words now have a different poignancy attached to them. So this was exactly that. I felt this was beautifully done. And I understand, again, to conclude this conversation, I understand why people are so angry at Game of Thrones, because it has subverted their expectations. But again, that was exactly what Game of Thrones set out to do. This was why you watch Game of Thrones, because it is like life in a way. Yeah, I know there are dragons and there are zombies, but that's the rules of the world. But it is the way things happen in life. That I can personally say that also, that there have been people who I have been hurt by, and you think, I wish something bad happens to them. I wish, and it never, I've sometimes seen that bad things have happened to them, but I felt bad for that. Felt, perhaps not. And it's never the way you think it should be. People who are, you think that the proud people will have their comeuppance. You think that the bad people will have the world take revenge on them in a certain way. And that's the way it works in most novels. That's the way it works in most narratives, which is the satisfying end. Here it doesn't. So That's about it. I mean, I really liked Game of Thrones end season. I felt that it was brilliantly done. There are some seasons in Game of Thrones I don't like. I don't like some of the, I totally shut myself off as to... Okay, so there's a bit of bias here. I've never really liked the character of Dany, neither in the books, and I don't like Emilia Clarke herself. So in a way that I am biased a little way. So even in the middle seasons, whenever there would be something in Meereen on this, I would basically mentally switch myself off. I was least interested in what was going on there. The only thing that mattered to me was Arya and Cersei and Jaime and all and Tyrion. Okay, so all the people in Westeros were the only people I really cared about. Never really cared about any of the story happening outside Westeros, that the Iron Bank and all that, is who cares? And they've basically decided to drop all those angles anyways. So in a way, I don't feel any personal sense of loss that Khaleesi has become evil. So I'm perfectly fine. I never really liked Jon Snow that much either, by the way. My favorite characters were always... Number one favorite character was Jaime. Number one, by far. Then I would say Tyrion and Arya. Close to 2 and 3. I like Hound and all of those characters too. Okay. So from one drama, moving on to Bengal politics and the vandalism of Vidyasagar statue. So for those of you who haven't been following Bengal elections, as the elections draw to a close, or perhaps the state that has seen the most tumult in these elections, mainly because it's a state that BJP has really gone in with their dragons, because it is possibly the last bastion that has not fallen to them. And I still feel that it's not going to fall to them. I may be proven wrong in a few days. But so what happened was that there was an Amit Shah rally, and there was violence. Again, Bengal politics has always been marred by violence. This, if you read people saying that, oh, this is happening because of the BJP, you're going to be absolutely sure that either the guy is a buffoon or that guy has been paid. So there's no middle ground of that, because that is, anybody who has any knowledge of Bengal politics knows that Bengal politics has been way, way more violent than this. This is actually in Calcutta. Calcutta is a bubble in Bengal. So if your idea of Bengal politics is based on what you see in Calcutta, which actually is also pretty violent in terms of politics, then again, to use Game of Thrones, you haven't been paying attention. So it was not so much the violence that was, I think if the shock wouldn't have been if somebody had died so much as a statue being desecrated. So it was a statue of Ishwarchandra Vidyasagar. Now, for those of you who don't know who Ishwarchandra Vidyasagar is and haven't Googled it already, so Ishwarchandra Vidyasagar was a Bengal social reformer, and he was a very strict observant Brahmin man, in the sense that he was always dressed in the classical Brahmin garb. And except the only thing that was, even though he looked like the most conservative Brahmin pandit of those days, he was an extremely liberal human being who, if Ramon Roy first passed the Sati Abolishment Act, he basically tried to get widows remarried, so much so that he it was not just a, you know, something abstract. You go and marry the widows. His son married a widow. He was also a great educationist. Some of the textbooks that he wrote are still, I don't know if they're still read today, but when I was growing up, they would be read as like the first primer for learning Bengali. But his biggest contribution was that he was a true Bengali intellectual. He was a true liberal in the sense that, you know, he brought in a revolution in Bengal in terms of widow remarriage. And he is in general an extremely non-controversial, universally loved figure in Bengal. And so in the optics, so when his statue gets desecrated, it's not just any place. It's not like vandalizing an ambassador car. It's something a little different. Now, who did it? And more importantly, why did they do it? So as with everything, we will never know who did it. There is equal possibility that Trinamool Congress did it, and there's equal possibility that the BJP did it. So why would BJP have done it? So the BJP could have done it, not as, how should I put it, not as part of strategy, I don't think any political party, if they are trying to get a single, trying to get votes in Bengal, would go and break a statue of Ishwarchandra Vidyasagar. That is, just cannot happen as part of strategy. So if the BJP had done it, it would have, it was possibly something spontaneous that happened when the violence was going on. And it was possibly done by people who were not Bengalis. So it, I'll come back to this. Can a Bengali break a Vidyasagar statue? And the answer to that is yes, because they have done it before. So again, I'm going to choose Occam's razor, which is that, you know, when you have multiple possibilities, you choose the one that is simplest. So it was most probably an unplanned vandalism thing. The person who broke the statue was possibly didn't even know whose statue he was breaking, and who was possibly not a Bengali either. I don't. So there were a lot of newspapers who said these are, you know, Amit Shah brings all his people from outside. This is again Bengali parochialism at its best. People who don't speak Bengali are by definition considered to be from outside, even if they have been living in the city for 200 years. Okay. So as a Bengali myself and as a proud Bengali, I have no problem calling out that aspect, that very, that aspect of Bengali parochialism that does not sit with me at all. It's never sat with me, is that we tend to otherize two kinds of people. One is Marwaris, who we otherize because they're richer than we are. And then there's another kind of people we otherize, which is Hindustanis, which are really Biharis and UPIs, who are poorer than we are. So,
and this term Hindustani is a generic one?
It's a generic one. So it's Marwaris and Hindustanis. These are the words that, this is, these are the
wow
kind of quasi-pejorative labels that Bengalis like to use for them. So it's Hindustanis and Marwaris. So they said, so there is, so Hindustanis have their bastis, which are chawls, and they kind of stand out because they don't do Durga Puja, they do Chhat Puja. Okay, so they're kind of different. They don't, they're not Bengalis, and they don't mix. And then there are the Marwaris who celebrate Diwali on Kali Puja on the wrong days. You know, Diwali and Kali Puja are not on the same day. Okay. So they burst crackers on the wrong day because they do it on Diwali while we do it on Kali Puja. So they always stand out. So these two people were always considered to be others. And BJP and these kind of parties were considered to be their parties. And CPM, Trinamool, these were considered to be Bengali parties. So Bengali parochialism is inbuilt into the DNA of both CPM. And now, as I've told this, Trinamool. So Trinamool is essentially CPM under a new name. There is no difference between them. It's all the same people also in many ways. So in the perspective of that, for BJP to go, given the kind of image that they have, given that anti-BJPism is always couched in a very, very, all in a very parochial way often, that, you know, those people are outsiders. They're coming and bringing their cow culture here into Bengal. You know, that's, it's not true, because first of all, the veneration of cow has been very old in Bengal itself. Again, the people who say it obviously are unaware of their own cultural and literary heritage. There's a short story called Mohesh about a cow, which was written about a love for a person's cow, that was written in the 1940s, I might be wrong. So the 40s are very early, 1940s, 1930s. So it's just, it's not true also. It's not, objectively, it's not even true. And cow lynchings and stuff have happened in Bengal also. And they happen not because there is any political party, because in villages, the cow is like your Mercedes. Okay, it is the most visible, it is the most valuable thing you own. And it is something which is very difficult to secure. So given the fact that in the rule of law is loose or lax in the villages, and then people know that cops don't really care for human beings, far less for cows, there's always been a tendency to take the law into your own hands when it comes to people who steal cows. And so this is the same thing as, you know, go in Calcutta. I've discussed this in previous podcasts where I've seen people being lynched, you know, thieves being lynched. In Calcutta, there aren't cows to steal. So people would come and steal radios in those days. Okay, so this, I betray my age when I say thieves would come to steal radios. So this was radios, TVs were, you know, those bulky TVs were a little bit difficult to steal, but radios were eminently stealable. So it's when somebody comes to steal the most prized possession that people become violent, because they know, okay, if we leave him, then ask the cops to get him, the cops will let him go because they'll be bribed. They'll bribe the cops and let him go. So let's punish him. So lynching violence, cow violence has always been in Bengal. Okay. It's just that the Bhadrolok haven't looked at it. And now with BJP, everything gets like everything has a reason now. It's because Amit Shah and Modi are sitting there in Delhi and are pressing a remote control, and boom, cow violence starts. It's amazing that the kind of mental gymnastics you need to do to even think that in our country you can cause things as easily as this in such a chaotic place. But leave that aside. So with Vidyasagar, for the BJP, it absolutely makes no sense to break the statue of Vidyasagar. It just makes no sense from a party perspective. As I said, if it was done by BJP personnel, it was possibly done as by people who did not know who Vidyasagar was. It was just done part of violence. So there was violence from both sides, as is very common in Bengal. I'm not saying that the BJP are saints. I'm not saying that the Trinamool are saints. It happened and the statue got broken, just as other things got broken. Now, there is the other thing. Could Trinamool have done it? And see, for Trinamool, it makes sense to do it because as a false flag operation, there could be nothing better. This basically affirms the worst about BJP just before Calcutta is going to the elections. This confirms exactly what they have said about BJP, that these people from outside give a shit about Bengali culture and they're such Philistines that they go in and break the statue of Vidyasagar. This is equivalent, I would say, for those of you outside Bengal, would be to vandalize a Ram statue in Uttar Pradesh. This is, in Bengal, we are not so close to our religious icons as we are to our cultural icons. So if you break the statue of Rabindranath Tagore, if you break the statue of Vidyasagar, if you break a statue of Vivekanand, there will be hell to pay if you do that. Hell to pay. I mean, this is the straw. This is the line. And what happened is this will have an effect, I'm telling you. Because this is, as I said, people do not vote in elections based on data. They vote based on anger. They vote based on emotion. And this is exactly the thing, the exact emotion card to play in Bengal, is if you desecrate the statue of Vidyasagar or Rabindranath Tagore or Subhash Chandra Bose or any of those cultural icons that Bengalis basically considered as, you know, as an alternative to the pantheon of gods. I'm not saying Bengalis are religious too, but we have another pantheon of gods, which are our cultural icons. And we are not tolerant if somebody comes and breaks their statues. Which brings me to, we have broken their statues before. So during the Naxalite Andolan, the statue, the entire tide of popular... When the Naxals first started their reign of terror in Calcutta, they actually had a lot of sympathy from the people in the city because they were seen as intelligent, smart college boys who were fighting for some kind of ideal. And they were also arrayed against the Congress. The Congress had been ruling the states ever since independence at this point of time. So in the Siddhartha Shankar Roy and other Congress, they were seen as like, people were always like, there's always this anti-government feeling. And it kind of plugged in. So the Naxalites were heroes for a long time. People were abating them. They were providing them shelter from the police. Till a number of events started happening. And one was the murder in broad daylight of the Jadavpur University vice chancellor, who was very, very well liked. Very well liked. And another was the desecration of a statue of Vidyasagar. So these turned the tide of popular opinion against the Naxals. Few of these.
You're saying the Naxals broke the statue?
Yes. So the press said that the Naxals had broken the statue. The reason why they had broken the statue was that they were against all Brahminican symbols and icons. Okay, and he was a very, very observant Brahmin. Every Naxalite ex-Naxalite have ever talked to always said this was done by the police. The police did it. They did it because they also knew that this is it. If they can blame this on us, I mean, people, when they were killing policemen, people actually supported the people who were killing the cops. But if you break the statue of Vidyasagar, that at that point of time, you have stepped into a place from which you cannot escape. People hate you. So the murder of the Jadavpur University vice chancellor was again one of them. So they, again, nobody knows who did it. But according to ex-Naxalites, including one of our professors at Jadavpur University, okay, who was there at that point of time, he said, you know, none of them were done by Naxalites. No Naxal in Jadavpur University would touch the vice chancellor. He was loved so much. It was done by Gundas who were in the payroll of the police. They're like Salwa Julum kind of people. Okay. So they were not cops, but they were extra constitutional authorities under the umbrella of the law, essentially. And that they did multiple things in order to turn the tide against Naxalites. One was this, one was the breaking of the statue of Vidyasagar. So the point that I'm saying is that this has happened before. So there's something very historical about this. And those of us who have kind of been followed Bengal politics for a while know that there is something attached to the Vidyasagar statue breaking that really turns popular opinion. So again, I don't know who did it. I will never know. And I'm not the kind of person who gives into conspiracy theories. And again, this is something which is so sensitive. I don't even know who did it. I think I honestly feel that it was an accidental act. You know, if you really ask me to take a stance and say this was an accidental act, I don't think anybody came in with a desire to break with the Vidyasagar statue. But it is also true that there is a history behind this and that this will have some kind of... I mean, let me put it this way. Nothing else could have had as much electoral impact as this. If they had killed 5 people, it wouldn't have had a big electoral impact. But that image of Vidyasagar statue broken with the head on the ground... That is the kind of emotion which will sway people when they go and press the button. I can guarantee you that at least in Calcutta, that is going to sway a significant number of people. And I think it's ironic that this is not the first time this has happened. And this is not the first time that a significant number of people believe that it was a false flag operation. Again, I don't know what happened. It could have been the Naxals who took the statue, because it was true that the Naxalites in their literature were against Rabindranath Tagore, against anybody, any of the cultural icons. Remember, the Naxalites were against religion. Okay, they were against all kinds of religious and cultural icons. So just as they were against religious icons, they were also, as I said, in Bengal. These are all Bengali Naxalites. And so they know that Vidyasagar and Rabindranath Tagore are no less than Shiva and Vishnu in the state. So they were against them as iconic figures also. So it was not as if this was totally out of character for them to have done it. But it is also true that according to many of them, no matter what they write in their literature, there's one thing saying that destroy the statues, and there is a totally different thing as to going and actually destroying a statue of somebody they themselves in a way venerate. All of them, at least that was the story that I've heard, that you, no matter how big a Naxal you are, no Bengali can ever go and break a statue of Vidyasagar. There's a line, there's almost an invisible line that will prevent you from doing that. Because you're such a non-controversial, blameless person who just basically all his life served other people. It's just inconceivable that you would ever do this. I mean, it's not a controversial figure. Like Rabindranath Tagore, Vidyasagar, they're not like Gandhi. Okay, there's no negative legacy that any of them ever had. They were the most least controversial figures ever. The only thing that you would read about them is good things. So again, we will never know, but we will definitely know if this had an effect on the Bengal elections. So that's about it for today. So I think we're kind of out of time. There were some other things which I wanted to discuss, but we'll leave that for another day.
Yeah, we started off with Game of Thrones, and of course we moved on to I wouldn't exactly say it's Bengal politics. Yeah, but I guess incidents took place in Bengal. But while you were talking, I was thinking about, you know, I think every pocket of India has these, you know, do not cross this line kind of a thing. And every now and then people do cross it, you know, either just to prove a point or to pass on the blame to somebody else. Well, yeah, that's pretty much been our episode for today, episode 41. Last week, we had a quick fire episode with Arnab. Again, I think we covered the entire news. So based on the feedback given by our readers, by our listeners, rather, we are going back and forth between both these formats, of course, and we will be having guests every now and then. So we are not sticking to any particular format, I think, for now, which has been, I guess, the ask from people. It's been a very fractured mandate. Which, again, I hope it's not a sign of things to come on Wednesday. So that's pretty much it. Do send in your feedback to us on appodcast@talkingstuff.net, which people have seemed to stop sending emails. We are only getting WhatsApp messages. And our WhatsApp number is 96525-78833, 96525-stuff@+91 if you're outside India, because that's the country code for India. So send in your questions or your comments, and I'll make sure that Arnab... I do forward all of these things to Arnab. So even if you're not necessarily addressing it in the podcast, be assured that Arnab sees every one of the messages that you do send to us. That's pretty much it. And any passing words of wisdom, Arnab?
No, I'm very looking forward to tomorrow's finale, and I'm looking forward to Wednesday's finale to see who sits on the Iron Throne.
Okay. Everyone, then take care, then see you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye, everyone.